Spirit Radio Podcasts.
We talked to our next guest 2 months ago in the run-up to the European and local elections. As party leader of Renew It, he said he laid out what he saw as his vision for the party. And in the local elections that followed, his own performance was very strong, topping the polls in County Offaly, but his party failed to get any other candidates elected. And on Tuesday, John Leahy announced his decision to step down as the leader of Renew It. On the line now to talk about that decision, we have Councillor John Leahy, former leader of Renew It. You're very welcome to the show, John.
Good morning, Ronan.
First of all, John, was this a hard decision?
Yeah, it was probably one of the hardest decisions I had to make in my political career, and I suppose in my work career as well. I've given up a full-time position in the Leinster GAA to take on the leadership role and give it 100%, and effectively I've made myself redundant. But so from that point of view, it's a hard decision when you have a family. But
of course,
the right decision for the very simple reason is that you've outlined yourself, Ronan, there. I was leader of the party for the last 3 years. We put 27 candidates back in the field. We had one European candidate and failed to get anyone elected outside of myself. So from that point of view, it is a failure on my behalf, and I have to recognise that, and that's what I explained to the board on Monday night, and that's why I announced my decision on Tuesday morning to step aside, to allow someone else to drive the party forward. Clearly the message that I was trying to articulate wasn't resonating, and from that point of view, I think it's the right decision.
You know, you're saying that in terms of not resonating, but I wonder, do you think voters know what Renew It really stands for?
Well, that was my job. When I started 3 years ago, I was highly critical of ourselves and within the party in terms of under the remit of Lucinda. Not Lucinda in particular, because in fairness to Lucinda, every time she went to go on the radio to explain to us what we were about, it was always about her and Enda, and you're talking to him and not talking to him.
She never got to talk about the party at all.
So she never got the chance, to be honest. But I felt that I was going to have the chance to travel around the rest of the country, and by bringing candidates on board and going to public meetings and having campaigns, that we could actually sell that message, and I wouldn't have that hanging over me. But it just didn't happen, Ronan. I got a couple of appearances on a couple of shows, let it be national, let it be local, let it be regional. But like, you take our stance on the pro-life issue, and I even seen it in my own hometown, and this resonated when we met the candidates on Saturday. We met the 27 candidates on Saturday in my hometown, and people know that I have a pro-life stance. I had people in my office that cried in my office that were staunch Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Yeah.
Three stood at a church cake election 3 weeks before the local elections and swore to me 4 months before that they'd never vote for Fine Gael again. I had one person that stood at my set in my office and cried her heart out, but yet ended up canvassing the town of Kilcormac.
It's mad, isn't it?
So what do you do when you stand up for something and for a referendum that meant so much to so many people? And the bottom line here is the pro-life voters went back and voted for the mainstream parties.
Yeah, they didn't punish them in any way for being so kind of opposed to the pro-life view. It's kind of, I found that kind of a little weird too, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, and we put a huge amount of effort into trying to get a situation whereby that we would put a mediator in place between Antu and ourselves, and try to make sure that we didn't crisscross. That failed to materialise. Now, and that's no fault of anybody else, I suppose, time against us. But like, I'm disappointed from the pro-life side point of view. I think that it's going to be very, very hard to resonate it when you don't have core pro-life people voting for parties that are actually pro-life. And I think that element of it will need a serious review. But there's other elements of the party that did resonate with people. Our law and order policies, people realised we were very, very tough on law and order. Some people felt we were too tough, but we do feel that there's a crisis happening in this country with criminals kind of getting the run on things and not
There's no doubt, John. I have your leaflet here in front of me, and I was looking at the six pillars, and I was going, putting the taxpayer first, entrepreneurship, law and order, pro life, nation state, cohesive society, and I just thought to myself, do you know what it is? That is really complicated. Like, I was just thinking, and I'm not saying there's any connection in any way, but you know, like, Antu were straight in with life, unity, economic justice, bang, that's it, done. And I just thought, you know, actually, there's nothing I would particularly disagree with on that, but actually there's an awful lot to it. It's kind of complicated, and that can create a problem for people understanding what it is you really stand for. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great point, Ronan. And look at the Greens. The Greens had one very simple message, and basically, they won an election. In fairness, they were the success story of the election. But it's amazing you said that, Ronan, because back in 2016 when I took over as leader, we actually had, at that stage, we had a 76-page manifesto that we fought the general election 2016. And everyone said, you've overcomplicated, you've too many policies, you've too much of an opinion on everything. Yeah. And we tried to downsize it. But I do agree with you.
Yeah, this is the downsize it again. Yeah, exactly. And do you think, I mean, you mentioned Lucinda earlier on, do you think Renew still struggles to get out from under the shadow of Lucinda Crichton?
I think so. I think, on Saturday, I had a lot of candidates who were canvassing in areas that we wouldn't have anyone that ran in the general election. We're still asking, is Lucinda still in the party? Do you know what I mean? And in fairness, when you're a leader of the party and you're still hearing the former leader's name being mentioned, I have to ask myself questions. Listen, I'm not getting the message out here nationally, and someone else needs to do this. And that's the reason. That's another reason as well. Lucinda's name is always linked to it. And rightly so. Lucinda took a brave, brave stance in what she'd done. She paid a dear price for it. Nobody's thanking her for that now. And she suffered politically, both herself and her husband, in terms of the stand that she has taken. But listen, hopefully life is good to her at this point in time, and she's away from it. But yes, Ronan, I suppose to answer your question, yeah, Lucinda's name has never left the parties, or the shadows of the parties, in terms of being on the doorsteps, because people say, how's Lucinda? So 3 years, 3 to 3 years onwards, if we haven't even shaken that, it's time for me to step aside. And I'm a type of person that takes full responsibility. I'm not looking to blame national boards, not looking to blame candidates. At the end of the day, I always use the analogy, Ronan, that I'm the manager of a team. We trained hard for 3 years for the first round of the championship, and we didn't win the first round of the championship. And you're not going to be left as manager of any hurling or football team if you're 3 years at it and don't win the first championship match. And that's my analogy of it. And
I think that's very, and it is an honourable thing to do as well, John. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm going back as an independent. I started out as an independent. I was affiliated with no political party when I started out in 2009. I'm coming from a GAA background. I spent most of my working life working for the GAA as a games development administrator. Very, very fortunate to actually have a job that I actually thoroughly enjoyed, and then walked into another job that I thoroughly enjoyed for the last 3 years. So I'm very, very fortunate. But what I'm going to do now is I'll take a couple of weeks off, naturally enough, and then I will be looking for employment back maybe in some shape or form in maybe August, September. And I'm hoping the general election will come, because I will contest the general election as an independent. My dream has always been to get to Dáil Éireann. I'm 10 years trying to get there. I've contested 3 local elections, which I've been successful. I've contested 2 general elections. The last one I lost out by 150 votes.
Wow.
Under Renew banner. So I feel I'm close to it, and I'd love to get across the line and be a TV. And that's really it, Ronan. I like to think I work harder. I'm a community activist, and I'll continue to do that. But at the end of the day, it's the will of the people if they're going to decide if it's worth me or not.
Can I just ask you? You know, you really now have like an honours degree in getting small parties established. How hard is it for a small party to get established?
Impossible. I tell you why it's impossible. We're very fortunate where we are now in terms of Renew are, because we received 2% of the funding. But when I was involved with Lucinda at the start, we had no money. There is no state support to actually start a political party. So, and you're restricted in terms of the donations you can get. Nobody's going to give you a loan. And it's really all on voluntary help. So what Lucinda had achieved was massive, to get 2%. But when we got to 2%, then we were entitled to state funding. That's why I was able to become a full-time leader. But now, if that runs out, so say what happens if Renew goes forward and I hope to God that they do get the 2%, they have to get over 50,000 votes in the next general election to get 2%, to get state funding. If they don't get that, it's going to be very, very difficult. Now, I think with the national board, it's there. They do certain things that need to be changed, whatever they feel it is. I hope to God they do get the 2%, because I think we need an alternative party there. But if you came to me in the morning and said to me, John, we have the policies, we have it simplified, let's start a political party, unless you have high profile people that's going to be on the television at least once every 2 weeks, you're going nowhere. And the problem you have is high profile people go to the mainstream parties or go independent.
And, you know, speaking of small parties, do you think there's space, you know, now that you're looking from a bit of a distance, is there space for both Renew and Aonthu in the Irish political landscape?
Without a doubt. without a doubt. Because I think if you look at the one common thing to have to get, is the pro-life issue. I do believe that that has to be worked on, and not to trip each other up in constituencies and be fighting for the same vote. But I economically, into is to the left. You can say renewal would be very much to the right. So from that point of view, they're poles apart from that point of view. But there's definitely room for them. There's definitely room for renewal. And in fairness, Ronan, if we don't have an alternative voice out there, what have we then? We're just falling back into the same trap. Because you could meet 10 people on the street, 10 out of 10, 7 would say we need change. But I don't know if people really want change or know what change is. And I think that's where the difficulty is.
Absolutely. Well, Councillor John Leahy, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And I really wish you the very, very best in the future. Former leader of Rail Ireland, thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, relationships and sexuality education has been in the news a lot recently, and many parents who want to hand on a Christian view of sexuality to their children can understandably feel under threat by what seems a relentless push to exclude. But do parents have a clear enough view of what relationships and sexuality education should be, rather than just a concern about what it should not be? In studio now to talk about a positive vision for sex education in our schools, we have columnist and blogger and recent graduate from Oxford University, Ben Conroy. You're very welcome to the show, Ben.
Great to be here, Ronan.
So, first of all, Ben, do you think the debate on RSE needs to be reframed?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. There's this whole, as you put it very neatly, people are freaking out a bit. People will see, okay, this is happening, a cord being kicked out of Educate Together school, we want to do sex education a different way. General pushes for the content of sex education to be changed in a way that sometimes isn't very friendly to Christian ethics. And what's the response to that? Sometimes people act as though the response to it is to sort of fight that battle on that turf. And maybe there's some role for that. Yes. But I think a lot of the thing needs to be rethought and reframed in the following way. Parents need to sort of step up. You know, I'm a Catholic, but across the Christian tradition, the general idea has been that the main sexual educator is the parent. So the parent actually talks to the child, explains their values, talks them through facts of life, answers their questions in an age-appropriate but honest way, and imparts your values that way. If you don't do that, and you're expecting, you're kind of saying, okay, I feel a bit awkward about doing this. And, you know, people feel awkward about these things. It's understandable.
Sure.
But if you're expecting the school to pick up the slack for what you as a parent ought to be doing, you're unfortunately setting yourself up for disaster, basically.
Absolutely. Like, there is this feeling that, you know, I think every parent feels not up to it, really, to be honest. You know, I don't think there's any parent, even parents who go out and this is their job to do this, feel like when they suddenly look into their eyes of their you know, and the problem is you're looking into the eyes of somebody that you actually still, even though they're, you know, maybe 10 or 11 or 12.
They're your little kid.
In your head,
baby,
they're
yeah.
three.
Yeah, exactly right.
If you're looking at them and you're seeing the three-year-old, it does something. But here's the thing. If you abdicate that responsibility, you're getting yourself into trouble. Is that the point?
It is. And I think there's a concern that a lot of parents who have Christian values or to be Christians would have, which is people learning stuff too early. I'd humbly propose that we need to worry a bit less about people learning stuff too early and worrying a bit more about people learning the wrong things.
Exactly.
Two children, everything's kind of strange. You know, my little goddaughter was at the zoo recently and, you know, there was an orangutan above her and she was like, oh, monkey. But then also she picked up a little leaf from a hedge and looked at it for a while and just, you know, was squatting down fascinated by the leaf as these animals were kind of swarming around her.
Exactly, yeah. Wonderful.
And there's this sort of sense in which everything is odd and strange and wonderful. And so sometimes if you're able to introduce the topic at a reasonably young age in an age-appropriate way, there's this great article online which I recommend people Google by MZ, the two initials MZ, Hemingway. It's called 8 Tips of Talking to Your Kids About Sex from a Christian Perspective. And one of the things that Hemingway says is she says, look, don't have the talk. Have a lot of talks. Have, like, you know, answer people's questions, bring things up in an age-appropriate way in kind of bits and chunks. And kids are not going to be traumatized by learning information in an age-appropriate way. You know, they're not going to have their innocence ruined. I learned about some of the facts very, very early.
Sure.
And, you know, it was just kind of like, yeah, that's the way the life is, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I often think, like, if you're the eldest in a large family, like I was, and there's a lot of babies coming, you get to figure out what's going on.
Right.
And actually, there's nothing weird about it. It's very normal. And you know, sometimes, you know, this is again, you know, coming from a therapeutic point of view, I often think that the reason the parents actually, they're very quick to say better to hold off until they're older is really more about my discomfort than it is about theirs.
I think that's sometimes true. And sometimes people just have a sincere belief, but I think it's a belief that's worth re-examining, I think.
Yeah.
And the great thing about talking about this stuff early is you can kind of move on. You can kind of, you know, when we're talking here about, you know, how we should approach sexual education, it's not just about the facts, it's about the values.
Absolutely, yeah.
And when you're able to start actually building up this really positive, really rich, really authentic vision of what Christian sexual ethics is all about, you know, study after study shows that parents are much more influential in children's lives than is generally given credit, you know?
Yeah.
But when people look at, when you look at polling, and I'm sure you've encountered this with your own background, that people actually, people's parents and what their parents say to them is one of the highest sources of information that the kids rate.
Yeah.
Above schools and above peers, actually.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to think you could have a big role there.
Yeah, and it's funny because, again, as a parent, you feel your authority getting eroded. But that's simply just because they're getting older and they're starting to listen to more stuff, but they still take a lot of notice, don't they?
They really do.
they really do. So look, where can parents turn for guidance on how to teach RSE? I mean, that article by Hemingway sounds fantastic.
It's super good. It's one of the best resources that's out there. It's actually funny. In terms of equipping parents properly, sometimes resources are a bit more buried than you think. You know, when I was doing Googling around for stuff, there's a lady called Alwyn Mark who's been working on this program kind of for schools, but it's a lot of stuff is adaptable for parents too. And we can talk about schools as well. But it's this kind of virtue and excellence based approach to sex education.
Alwyn Mark.
Yeah, Olwyn Mark.
Okay.
And she's got some really, really interesting stuff out there. This article's a really, really good starting point. A lot of it is just, it's just saying, what do I actually believe? What are my values in this area? In the same way as somebody would say, okay, how do I want my children to approach money? Mm-hmm. How do I want my children to approach kindness and decency in the area of friendship? You know, how do I want to approach honesty? Treating it like another area in which you can be excellent or not, another area in which you have to develop as a person, become a more virtuous person, become a more integrated person, and actually figure out, rather than seeing it as this completely separate, unique area, see it as a part of the authentic development of a person.
Yeah, it's, you know what, you're so right. And it's, and because of the discomfort around, specifically around sexuality, people kind of put it into that box. And I even like the way you say, you know, don't have many talks.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because that is much more integrated.
There's nothing more awkward than saying, kind of like, okay, if you're afraid of awkwardness, sitting down and saying, we're going to have the big talk now, it's going to make it harder for you harder for the kid.
Yeah.
Whereas usually kids will ask a lot of questions. If you actually take an opportunity to answer a question, you can make it a bit easier for yourself down the road because you answer their one piece of information. Don't necessarily tell them the whole spiel. Kind of one good tip that Hemingway gives is sort of, if somebody asks you a question, you're not quite sure how to answer it, say, why are you interested? Why did you want to know? How did this come up? Sometimes it'll have come up in a conversation with a peer, because kids talk about this stuff even at relatively young ages in school and such like. And they'll often want to know for a very specific reason. They'll want to know a very specific thing. And you can answer that thing without going into, you know, everything.
Sure.
And take it on a piece-by-piece basis.
Yeah,
and help people build up the picture.
So, as you said earlier on, let's turn to schools now. The role of schools seems to have changed in recent years, and the government seems less interested in providing RSE that respects desires. Maybe this is an overstatement, but it seems, at least to me, that it's maybe less interested in providing RSE that respects the desires of Christian parents. What do you think the school's role should be in RSE?
I think there's basically two distinct roles that a school can play, and it probably won't play both. The first is just backing up the parents, essentially. So in other words, this is a situation where you've got a bunch of parents who've come together to form a school and they have similar values on this question.
Right.
So that's one thing.
Yeah, so the school is aware of what the value is and then just backs it up.
And then basically backs it up and kind of and is sort of filling out and aiding the parents and discussing it and maybe sometimes picking up slack for when parents don't do their job. But fundamentally, it's a kind of a supportive role.
Okay.
Right? Now, the second thing is in a situation where parents and school have different values, right? Because, you know, let's not pretend. So Simon Harris may have tweeted recently, so, you know, this whole thing, the Castleknock Educate Together school, where they, Accord, were coming in, Catholic group, to do sex education in their school, and the Educate Together school is, we don't want a Catholic group or a multi-denominational school, which is fair enough. Mm. But Simon Harris's tweet, on the other hand, I take it a rather dimmer view of. He said, you know, sexual and relationship health is integral to overall health and well-being. It's important our children have access to unbiased information. We must respect religious belief, but all health education must always be based on facts, not ethos. Now, I just don't know what that means.
Well, exactly, yeah. That's a lovely thought, but it sounds like it's somewhere in the background, I suspect, an agenda.
Well, it's just like, what are facts without ethos? He doesn't mean we're literally just going to talk about the biology.
Yes.
He means we're going to have a particular ethos, we're going to have a particular sexual ethic, which is probably going to be some variety of the following. If you have consent and informed consent and properly secured consent, then sex is ethical. If you do not have this, sex is unethical. And that's the view. And we're going to teach that as an ethic and as an ethos. And unfortunately, we're going to pretend that it's neutral and it's just fact-based. Yeah. Now, I would say, and this brings me to what that second role is, if parents have different values, we should first of all acknowledge that people have different values. That sex is an area where people have different moral views.
Sure.
No more so than on the economy. Yeah. You know, some people...
Money.
All this different stuff. You know, people
politics.
Have different views.
Yeah.
So what should the schools do in a situation where parents have different views? In my view, they should provide a minimum, but we should be a pretty high minimum for what ethical sex is. Mm. So I would say, regardless of religion, regardless of the kind of more holistic Christian view that I was talking about there, even without any of that, we can get higher, I think, than just consent only. Consent is a necessary part of ethical sex, but it's not a sufficient part.
Absolutely.
You know, absolutely, consent is just critical. But I would say we need consent, respect, and love.
Yeah, like consent is kind of the bare minimum.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And we should be teaching kids that it's okay to say sex belongs in an environment characterized by consent, respect, and love. Now, what does that look like in practice? Okay, so because you got to say, okay, these are nice words, Ben, but what are we talking about here? So if you're on a night out, and someone, there's good chemistry between you and somebody else, how can you love them the best? Don't ask the question, you know, what's the minimum I need to do to treat this person well? Ask what the maximum I can do.
Yeah.
So, for example, the key thing I think is, if you don't know a person's circumstances, if you don't know them, right? Mm-hmm. Sex is a really, really intimate act.
Yeah.
It's why it's really, really important. It's why sex crimes are so bad, because it's not just... it's not just like being punched. If you're a victim of a sexual assault, it's this horrifically traumatic thing, because sex is this incredibly intimate thing. So even without talking about crimes or without talking about violations of consent, talk about being a good person. Mm. How do you respect a person? How do you know what they need, what they want, what will be best for them, if you don't know them? And I would just, you know, humbly submit that you can't know. And that this is something that we can talk about in schools. We can talk about, no matter how well you kind of obey the box-checking exercise of consent, which you should do, mm-hmm. that's your bare minimum, you still can't know what's going to be good for the person that you're interested in. You can't know what they're looking for, what their background is, how to love them well, if you don't know them. So there's this move from the kind of the Harrises of the world and various people to say that any kind of talk about this is just sort of sex negative. Mm. It's moralistic and it's shaming. Mm. But I think it's just a matter of being excellent.
Yeah, and you know, I'm listening to you and thinking to myself that actually, of those three things, when you think of respect and you think of love and you think of consent, consent could be, I'm not saying it should be, but it can be a thing that you reduce to something you need to extract from somebody.
Right, absolutely.
You know, so it's like, you know that kind of idea that actually, what is the bare minimum I need to do to extract consent out of somebody?
Yep.
And that really, and you can't extract, you know, that's you don't do that with respect or love.
Right, 100%, Ron, I couldn't agree more. What weirds me out is, you know, I don't know if Simon Harris has read Karl Marx, but I know that some of the pieces, I know that Catherine Zapolin probably has, right? And so when some of these people talk about consent, they're very good in the area of economics of recognizing exactly what you talked about, that people with that, you know, there can be a formal consent to something, but it can be something that's extracted, that's pressurized, not even necessarily in terms of overt pressure, but in terms of social pressure,
exactly.
In terms of an expectation that you'll only be able to be involved in the relationships game in the world of dating, if you're willing to do certain things, if you're willing to sleep people and such like. They're really good at recognizing how social incentives can change the way you think about things and can impede the genuineness of your consent, right? Mm-hmm. But there's just a weird refusal to apply that same logic, which is good logic, to this whole area of relationships and sex education. And I think one way of recognizing that insight is to say, let's get away from the minimum. Let's get away from that situation where, as you say, it can be a situation of, I'm just trying to get the minimum, I'm trying to extract consent from someone, or even if you're not doing that, you don't know what's going to be the best for the other person unless you're adding on a lot more than just consent. And I think that should be the minimum floor that we set. We should raise our minimum floor. Even if we're not teaching, you know, hashtag full Christianity, the floor that we're setting in terms of what is our sexual ethics, I think we can do a lot better than just mere consent.
Consent, absolutely. So, I suspect I'm beginning to get a sense of what you're going to answer this question is. But to finish, what would a young adult who has gone through, you know, a positive form of relationship and sexual education look like?
I would say there'd be somebody who has, you know, Aristotle talks about virtues, and virtue is a word that has become a kind of unfortunately it has connotations now that it didn't used to. It seems a bit prissy, it seems a bit uptight, maybe. So I like to talk about excellence, which is another translation of the word that Aristotle used for virtue. It'd be someone who, in the area of sex, relationships, and caring for other people, was someone who was excellent. Somebody who was always thinking about people I'm involved with, how can I love them the best? How can I respect them? How can I understand what their needs are? And how can I, you know, offer myself to them well, you know? Now, I have my own view about what the ultimate expression of that is going to be. To me, the ultimate expression of that is going to be the incredible love and commitment that is held up as an ideal in Christian marriage. So from the first type of sex education I was talking about, it'd be somebody who understood the amazing power of the Christian sexual ethic and had both internalized it and expressed it lovingly. And for the B sort, for the sort of what is the kind of shared sexual ethic that we in Ireland should have now, it's going to be someone who approaches partners with consent, respect, love and care, and is looking to do more than just avoid the worst. Is looking to just do more than just avoid ending up in a criminal court. Is looking to be someone who is who's excellent.
Well, I tell you what, it's been an education and wonderful to meet and talk with you, Ben. Ben Conroy, a columnist and blogger, thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thanks so much, Ron.
Pleasure. In our weekly Life in Five interview, we talk to our guests about their lives, the ups and downs, and they do it by answering five questions that they choose from a short list. And our Life in Five guest today is Stephen Mawhinney. You are very, very welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Ronan. It's good to be with you.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, as you just introduced me, my name is Stephen. I'm, you know, married to Margaret. I am, you know, father of three kids, and just recently became a grandfather for the first time.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Beautiful granddaughter, little Harlow May.
Wow.
And I am the associate pastor in Talla Family Church there in Jobstown.
Absolutely. So, here are your questions. A favourite Bible verse and why?
My favourite Bible verse, Rowan, would have to be from the Gospel of Luke. I'd imagine Luke chapter 22, verse 31. And it says, Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith won't completely fail. And when you are returned to me, strengthen your brethren.
And so I know, tell me all about that.
Yeah, I know.
That's very interesting Bible verse.
It's an unusual verse. But long story short, it's very, very precious to me because, you know, as a young lad, you know, I grew up in a Christian home and, you know, came to a personal knowledge and faith in Jesus as a person as a very, very young lad. And I can honestly say I, you know, genuinely loved him very, very much. And I used to love reading my little children's Bible and all of that thing. And I go as far as to say, as a young lad, I had a personal relationship with the Lord Jesus. But sadly, for different reasons, when I hit around perhaps 12, 13 years of age, and I was attending Wesley College at the time, and I started to play, you know, a lot of rugby. And I had grown up in what you call, you know, a teetotal family. You know, neither of my parents smoked or drank, and neither of my grandparents, or as far back as I know. But, you know, for different reasons, I started experimenting with alcohol and different stuff, and it wasn't long before it got a hold on me, and my life basically spiraled out of control. You know, I left home when I was about, I just turned 17, and, you know, even, you know, when I was writing about it, you know, in the book, it brought up a lot of feelings, you know, that had lain dormant for years when I realised it's what I put my parents through. My parents, you know, had certain rules and regulations, and rightly so, there was boundaries that none of us were, you know, permitted to cross. I had four younger sisters, and, for example, you know, I wasn't allowed to bring alcohol into the house or drink alcohol in the house. I wasn't permitted to bring girlfriends up to my bedroom to study, you know. Sure. I don't really know what, you know, that would have entailed. But I wasn't permitted to do that. You know, I had to be home by certain times, you know, which, looking back, were very, very reasonable. I wasn't allowed to, you know, obviously, you know, swear and curse and blaspheme and vent in the home. And to me, you know, going through a very rebellious phase from maybe the age of 14 onwards, and I'd stopped attending church when I was around perhaps 13, 14. You know, my dad was a pastor, and I remember him calling us all for church one morning. And one thing then, as a teenager, and even now, one thing I've always despised is hypocrisy. I could never understand how, you know, people could be, in a sense, running with the hare, chasing with the hound, looking very holy and spiritual, you know, at a religious service on a Sunday, and, you know, living a life completely contrary to that.
Yeah.
You know, during the week.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I started to do that, and I just hated it because it was hypocrisy. So I told my dad that I wasn't going to church, and I didn't want to be a Christian anymore, and that I didn't want to, you know, attend any more Christian meetings or functions or camps, things like that. And I can still remember the pained look on his face. But to get a long story short, you cut me off now, if I'm...
No, you're doing great. You're fascinated.
Yeah, no, but long story short, Ronan, when they had, and obviously my behaviour and my rebellion got, you know, worse as I went on in my teens. And I thought these rules were completely unreasonable. So what I did was I packed a rugsack and had a few belongings in it. And when I look back, it just fills me with dread, with horror. You know, it was absolutely appalling. You know, I acknowledge that. It was appalling. It was dreadful what I did. I had a motorbike at the time. Yamaha 125. I had a big vinyl record collection. It was the day of, you know, it was the time of Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, Bread, you know.
Yeah, you sound like the same era as myself.
Well, yeah, give or take, maybe. That's right. So I sold my vinyl collection, and this was all unknown to my parents. And I said goodbye to my mum this particular morning. I gave her a kiss, which wasn't normal. I didn't normally do that. But I knew what I was going to do. And I said, see you when I come home from school, Mum. And as soon as the door was closed, I retrieved my rucksack from the garage where we were living in Dundrum. I got a bus out to Dunleary, and I hopped on the ferry from Dunleary to Holyhead. I'd never been in London before. I may have been as a young lad, but I had heard about the West End. I'd heard about a place called Soho Piccadilly, and there was, you know, action to be found there. What kind of action I was expecting to find, I'm not sure. But I hopped on a train from Dunleary, went down to, or sorry, from Holyhead down to London, got a tube to the West End, and I came up out of Piccadilly Circus tube station, and the first hotel I saw was a hotel called the Regent Palace Hotel. So I booked in there, and it wasn't very, very long before my money ran out. And I then, at this stage, I was drinking quite heavily, believe it or not. All my pocket money as a young lad was going on alcohol, you know, we were smoking an awful lot of, you know, hash and weed at the time. So I bumped into a few lads who were roughly the same age as myself, and I noticed that they had a lot of money and they were able to sit in the pubs all day and drink. and I found out that they were signing on in different dole offices under different aliases, and this is what kept them in money, so I thought this was a great idea, so I did likewise, so we could sit in the pubs drinking all day. And to get a long story short, ended up homeless. There was always money for alcohol, there was always money for cigarettes, there was always money for hash, but very little was spent on food or accommodation. So I ended up homeless, and I ended up living in squats and sleeping in all-night cafes and anywhere you could just basically, on one or two occasions, park benches.
My goodness, that's an absolutely extraordinary story, Stephen. And you know, going back to that word about, you know, the specific Bible verse that you
excuse me
that you chose, how does that fit in?
Yeah, unknown to me, Ronan, it was around that time, and my mother, you know, she passed away, it would be 4 years ago, this coming July. But unknown to me, my mother was one of the old school Christian women. She was a real woman of prayer. She believed very strongly in fasting. And unknown to me, she was absolutely distraught. This was just prior to me going away to the UK.
She kind of knew something was up.
Yes, and she relayed the story to me 17 years later when the Lord restored me. But at that time, she was distraught, and she told me that she was at her wit's end about my behaviour, the way my life was going. And she went up to her bedroom to pray one night, and as was her custom, and she was really praying, and she asked the Lord, she said, "Lord, what are we going to do about this son of ours? We've done everything we can to try to bring him back to his senses. We've disciplined him, we've scolded him, we've grounded him, we've done everything, but it runs off his back like water off a duck's back." And she was crying, and she felt prompted to open her Bible, which she did, and she opened her Bible, and it fell on Luke chapter 22. And in her own words, as she started to read down through it, she had said to the Lord, "Lord, please, you know, speak to me, talk to me. What do we do? What do I do as his mother? He's my only son." And as she was reading it, and this is the way she described it to me, she said, it was as if verses 31 and 32 jumped out of the page at her. And she went back to read them again and again. And of course, these were words that our Lord had directed to Peter, the disciple. But in this context, the Lord, she believed, was redirecting those words to her personally.
So give them to us again, because it's been 10 minutes or so since you said them.
Luke 22:31, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith won't completely fail. And when you are returned to me, strengthen your brothers."
My goodness. We'll tell you what I'm going to do. We'll take a quick piece of music, and we're going to come back to the story, because this is absolutely fascinating. And I am speaking to Stephen Mawhinney in studio. We're doing our Life in 5 interview, and he has been giving me a most extraordinary story of his life, none of which I knew, despite knowing him for many years. But it's absolutely extraordinary. So you found yourself kind of homeless, really, in London, and trying to make your way through, and you discovered years later that your mother had received this verse from Luke, and it was about Peter, the Lord praying for Peter, saying, you know, Satan has tested you to sift you, but I've prayed that you'll be able to hold out. And what happened then?
Yeah, well, I didn't realise at the time, of course, Ronan, that she'd received that promise. But looking back now, I believe, in a sense, that's where, you know, the spiritual dynamic shifted, for want of a better word. I didn't realise it, but, you know, the Lord started to work in my life. So, behind the scenes. So what happened? I was in Piccadilly Tube Station, and for whatever reason, sitting there with some friends one day, and next minute a load of policemen, they just came in from every direction. They'd received a tip off. It wasn't anything to do with me or the company I was in, but a tip off that something was going on, and they did a raid. And long story short, they carted a load of us off. We were thrown into the back of you know, police vans, and I was picked up by two burly policemen and fired in to the back of this van, and brought to the police station. And it was in the police station that the whole sorry story came out. And this policeman, the London Metropolitan Police, gave me a right ticking off, and it was well deserved. He said, am I understanding you right? He said, you have left home and you haven't told your parents where you are. They've no idea. And you've been away for about 4 or 5 months. Is that correct? And I said, that's correct. He said, you're an absolute disgrace. And he said, have you any idea what your parents must be going through? Long story short, they made contact with my parents, told them I was alive and well. And I decided then that I wouldn't return home. I was still too proud. I was too embarrassed. Different reasons. And my mother hails from Liverpool, and she had some family up there. None of them were Christians, so I was happy enough to go there. I didn't want to be staying with Christians. So off I went to stay with them. And it was great. They were really decent people. I'll always be grateful to them, my Uncle Andy, my Auntie Flo. But of course, I could drink to my heart's content. I could go to see, you know, Everton play at Goodison Park. I never got to see Liverpool play at Anfield because the one uncle I was staying with
was an Everton supporter.
Yeah, exactly.
The locals.
It's typical. Yeah. You know, so I never got my two sons, Nathan and Samuel, are big Liverpool supporters, and I have promised to bring them over sometime with Margaret, you know, to see a game. So long story short, stayed there for 2 years, came back to Ireland, and in my, I suppose, very, very early, late teens, ended up joining the prison service on the 17th of May, 1980. I say to people there, but the grace of God go any of us. I had never been arrested here in Ireland. I'd never been imprisoned here in Ireland, so therefore I wasn't known to the police. I heard that the money was good. I went in out of curiosity, joined the prison service. Amazing money in 1980. There was a recession on in the country, for those who are listening who are old enough.
Yes,
to know.
As I am.
Yeah,
those.
Huge recession.
Remember,
but
well,
we were earning with overtime, hand on heart. It was normal to take home, you know, to gross 1,000 punts a week. You would pay about £500 in tax, but to have a cheque for £500 back in 1980 as a 21, 22-year-old was
massive
huge
money.
It was massive.
Money. Yeah.
So that kept me in the alcohol and the lifestyle I was used to. And so I would be drinking 7 nights a week into early houses when we'd finish night duties, the Boar's Head, Capel Street. You'd come out at noon. You'd be sitting on a high stool at 7 in the morning. You'd come out at 1 o'clock. You wouldn't know your name, your religion, what day it was. Were you going into work? Were you finished? What shift were you on?
So how did the turnaround happen, Stephen?
How the turnaround happened was I decided that I would rent my house out, and the last people I wanted in the house, to be honest, Ronan, were Christians. I would have put anybody in except Christians. But the way the Lord worked it, there was four lads, and they happened to attend a church in Pier Street, you know, St. Mark's. They happened to move in. And I didn't want to meet them. I didn't want anything to do with them. A brother-in-law of mine handled the whole thing. And I said, listen, that's my account number. Get them to pay the money into that account and tell them not to be late. So this went on for about 2 years. And then, the long story short, I was living elsewhere. I decided that I wanted to move back into my house. So I gave these lads 6 months' notice. I was only required to give them three. They didn't want to leave. They asked if they could see me. And I always laugh at this part. I came up to the house, and this fella opened the door, and he said, hello, can I help you? I said, you certainly can. My name is, you know, and I introduced myself. And he said to me, he says, hello, brother. And I looked at him. That is used in some, you know, Christian circles, you know,
sure,
as a term of
sure.
Fellowship and endearment. And I said to him, I'm not your brother. I have no brothers. I have no interest in being your brother. I have four sisters. So I said, what's the problem? I have asked you to leave. You don't want to leave. So, to long story short, he gave me a big, big, long spiel. Have we paid the rent? I said, yes. Have you had any reports from neighbours? I said, no. So I moved back in, and I said, I am going to move back in on one condition, if you make me a promise. And he said, what's that? You or the other lads must never, ever, ever speak to me about the Lord or spiritual matters. Now, I will move back in if you do that. And I always throw this question out to people, you know, often say, you know, ethically, should Christians ever break their word? Because one of the lads, I moved back in, and there was a country lad, we won't mention any names, but there's a country lad staying there, and often he would tell me as to how he met the Lord, you see, and what the Lord had done for him. And to be honest, I was bored stupid. Inside, my eyes were rolling around in my head, and I used to listen to him out of politeness, but I was bored. And my wife says, you're still the same, Stephen, you go too far, your sense of humour is a bit off the radar. And I stress I was only joking in case listeners think I'm some kind of psychotic with mad mood swings. I stress I was joking. He was talking about the Lord, and I had forgotten to leave my prison baton back. I was going in on night duty that night, and I whipped it out of the side of my trousers and I held it to his head and I said, if you don't stop talking to me about the Lord, I will play a drum solo on your head with this baton.
Okay, Stephen, we have about 30 seconds to finish this story, and we've been on it for a while, so we better get to the point pretty quickly.
Right. Ronan, what happened? Long story short, following Sunday, woke up, terrible compulsion to go to church, went to Mark's in Pier Street. The pastor at the time was a guy called Gary Davidson.
Remember?
He was preaching away. God spoke to me very, very clearly. I'd never heard of any Christian songs. Shine, Jesus, shine. Two of the lines spoke to me. Shine through the darkness. I came out. I shot up a quick prayer. It happened the following Sunday. Same thing. Compulsion to go to church. Went to church. And it was that night that the Lord wonderfully met with me. And I believe by the power of his spirit drew me back to himself. And I came to see my life was a shambles. It was an absolute mess. I was a disaster. And it was just that night that no one told me to. I mean, I pray normally walking, sitting. But I just felt compelled that night. I just fell to my knees and I just said, oh, Lord Jesus, I've made a hames of my life, a mess. I've tried everything. It's left me empty. Please, Lord, you know, forgive me. And please use me, and please use me and do something with this life. And he did that.
Wow. That is absolutely extraordinary. We were supposed to be doing life in five, but that is really life in one. That's pretty amazing. And I want to give a quick mention to that book that's out, From Darkness to Light, A Testimony to What Only God Could Have Done. It's a lovely book. I've had a good read of it myself, and it's available in Footprints and
Christian Publication Centre in Middle Abbey Street.
Great, Christian Publication Centre in Middle Abbey Street as well. And can they get it online as well? Or?
Well, if they contact me, if for whatever reason they can't get into either, Ronan,
yeah,
if they can contact me, and I'd be more than happy to get a copy of them.
So, Stephen, yes,
sorry,
go ahead.
Sorry, and could I just thank very, very much, if he's listening, can I just thank Dougie from Footprints.
Yeah.
He's a gentleman, isn't he?
Isn't he just,
it was Dougie arranged this for me, this interview here with Spirit Radio, and I just want to thank Dougie Hobson there in Footprints. Yeah.
He gave it a good old plug the other day.
He was listening.
And it's terrific, and it's available for €10.
That's right.
And it's really now a great value. So, Stephen Mahoney, thank you so much for talking to us and being our Life in Five guest this morning.
Thank you, Ron.
God bless you. In studio, our next guest is a contemporary folk singer and songwriter raised in Monaghan, living in Kildare. She's been very busy recording and performing, and she has taken the time this morning to drop into the studio to give us a sample of what she's been performing lately. In studio now to tell us more, we have Gráinne Hunter. Very welcome to the show, Gráinne.
Thanks for having me.
You want to play us a little tune?
I am. Let's do it. So this is the first single that's off the new record coming up. That's called Breathe.
Breathe.
Bullets fly, landing either side of me. I close my eyes. Now I realize, in a war of words, it's best to wait for silent space. And breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in.
Look within and breathe in. Wounds will heal, scars endure, and echo on. I hear them cry as now I realize in a war of words it's best to wait for silent space and breathe out, breathe in. Breathe out, breathe in. Take your time, look within and breathe in. Quietly, clarity, and breathe out, breathe in. Look within and breathe in.
Lovely, lovely. Tell us something about that song, Breathe.
Well, I kind of wrote it as an idea that, you know, sometimes when you're having an argument with somebody, you don't even have to argue. If you take a step back and just take a breath and let that person keep arguing, they can just argue themselves into a little hole and you don't have to do anything. So that was the kind of idea behind it.
Yeah. Wow, that's really good. Powerful, beautiful song as well.
Thank you.
So you've just recorded an album in Nashville.
Yes.
Nashville's a bit of a trip, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Now, I went over and I managed to... I spent a few days in LA on a holiday first.
Sure.
And I went on up to the Pacific Northwest, then to Portland and Seattle afterwards. So I had 9 days in the city and it was just amazing. I was telling Dee, Anya outside, and I had such an amazing time. I met this amazing family that I stayed with and they put me up and they lived on a lake and we went canoeing in the sunset and came back after
Fantastic.
Dark under the stars and, you know,
So then you went and then recorded the album in Nashville. Who did you record with, by the way?
So I recorded with this guy called Tom Jutz. Yeah. He's a German guy who's lived in Nashville for about 15 years. And he kind of went there. That was his dream as a young person. He kind of discovered guitar and is an incredible guitar player himself. And I met him at the Belfast Nashville Festival at the beginning of last year. And I heard him talk about just recording and he just made it sound so easy. Mm. And it was really that. It was so straightforward and easy and quick. I mean, we did it. We'd scheduled in kind of 6 days. Mm. And on the first day you go in and you do your Nashville chart for the other musicians, you know, and that took a couple of hours. And then he let me off to kind of wander around the city and I came in the next morning and we started with the musicians and 2.5 days later we'd recorded the entire record and mixed it.
Phenomenal.
It was finished.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah. Like the players are just so on it.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
And that thing of wandering around the city and like every other door there's somebody playing behind. It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's mad.
So,
but just such a lovely vibe and kind of open and everyone's very Everyone's very open there. It's lovely.
And you know, the thing of being a musician, and of course I'm speaking from the perspective of having been a musician for many years, you know, in Ireland when you say you're a musician, you immediately get this worried expression. Oh, what's that like for you? How are you surviving? Well, that's desperate. Whereas when you're in Nashville and you say you're a musician, they're like, good for you!
Yeah.
Great, yeah! All right! So are you delighted with the final product?
Oh, like, I love it. I love it. And I think that's the thing, like, I've listened to it. I feel like I listen to it more than anything that I'd recorded before, you know?
Yeah, well, that says a lot. Yeah, I know. Yeah. You stand over it, you're able to listen to it and to enjoy it.
And like, I liked what I did before, and I did it. It was done in a different way, you know, but I just really, like, I was blown away. I'm blown away by how it sounds, you know, and I've played it to a few people, and like, I'm
very much looking forward to hearing these stories. We've got a 4-track CD, by the way, to give away in a moment, but I want to get through some other stuff first. So where did the songs in the album come from? What was the inspiration this time around?
I suppose, like, life, really. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Some of them relate to particular people, you know. There's a song called Sorry about somebody who doesn't like to say sorry, so I just wrote my own apology.
here's a song for you. Just take this out anytime you need.
Take it, just play it whenever you need to. There's one I wrote about an experience in the US. Again, I'd gone on a travel and training grant to LA, and I wrote kind of about where I was there, and that's the opening track of the record. And then the title track of the record is called This Secret. And it's about realizing that I love to be by the sea, and I started sea swimming last year. And
you're hardcore.
Yeah, it's grand in the summer, but do it on the 28th of December,
exactly, that is hardcore.
But yeah, so just life, I suppose.
Yeah, so you're in the middle of a busy schedule of live gigs. Can you give us we do have people listening in from all here and in the UK, so tell us where you are.
Yeah, so on Sunday night I open for Liam and Wanley in Connolly's of Lepp.
Brilliant.
And then I'm in a show called Ladies in the Blues, and we go to Glastonbury next weekend.
Brilliant.
We're actually playing in Blanchardstown on Saturday.
Yeah, you're in Dreacht. Well. Yeah, I see that. Yeah, brilliant.
And then I head off to Germany in the middle of July, followed by Slovenia and Vienna. And then I'm in America for the first 2 weeks of August. And then in October, I'm back to the UK, kind of in and around Liverpool and Merseyside and Sheffield.
I see you at Ballybuffet in Donegal.
I'm doing part of the July Arrigal Arts Festival.
Brilliant.
In the Ballar Arts Centre,
Great. Yeah. Is there anywhere people can get online to see all these dates?
I am everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just website, look up GroniaHunt.com. Yeah. Okay, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of that.
Great. Great. That's really good. And you're going to Slovenia. Is it Ljubljana? Or?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. I'm playing outside, like, their arts gallery or like their national.
That's like one of my favourite cities anywhere in the world. It's gorgeous.
Oh wow, great.
Gorgeous. Like, it's a little chocolate box, kind of, particularly that centre place in Ljubljana is gorgeous.
Oh, amazing.
So tell us real quick. Yeah, I'm looking at the time.
I know.
Ooh, yeah. Can you tell us real quick about the Pass the Hat gigs in Germany?
Yeah, you know, so I kind of, we were talking about this outside, because in Germany they do this thing where they'll advertise shows as free in cafes and bars and places that always have music. So these people show up. I did one in a place called Lübeck, and it was my second time there. All of the tables were reserved. There were people had to leave because there was nowhere to sit down. And at the end of the night, like, everyone's there for the music. They're there to listen, and they pass a hat around, and you make a really decent amount of money, like, you know.
Brilliant.
It was one gig I did.
It's like busking indoors, right?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, but you've got a captive audience for an entire gig.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just a few songs, you know.
Brilliant, yeah.
I did one where this guy had been running gigs for 15 years and he'd never had a silent collection until my gig.
Wow.
And then told me that there was another significantly large Irish musician had played there, and I'd made more money than him.
Yeah.
Delighted.
Score.
So yeah, it's great. I mean, I don't know if it would work here. I feel like Irish people might not.
You never know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You might be worth a try at some stage. Yeah. So look, we have a 4-track CD, Breathe, to give away. It's going to be Amy who's going to be announcing it, but it's Gráinne Hunt, Breathe, with 4 tracks on it. It has Breathe, You, Forever and Always, and This Secret Live. And if you want to be in the draw, text Gráinne Hunt to 087-888-9292 with your name. So that is it, you know, Gráinne Hunt to 087-888-9292 with your name. So we're going to do real quick, I'm going to jam this in now.
Okay.
the next song is?
Let Go.
Let Go. Go for it.
Now I see the people I've been drawn to teach me more. When to leave and when to stay and when to close the door. Words that drift with no real sense of what you really mean. A tangled web of push and pull, but you would not agree. I'm stupid. I don't think I'm blind. I just think there's a part of me that sees good in every kind. But I gotta let go. I gotta let go. By the love of it, the truth is hard to see. Those that cross our paths are there to bring us to our knees. Reminiscing on our past, the memories good and bad. Gathered up, I'll not forget the lessons that I've had. I don't think I'm stupid. I don't think I'm blind. I just think there's a part of me that sees good in every kind. But I gotta let go. I gotta let go. Whoa. Go. Hindsight has shown me all your ways. And I today, but I gotta let go. I gotta let go.
Thanks very much, singer-songwriter Gráinne Hunt. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.